Hello and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly performing arts radio magazine. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll talk with actor Ananda Benaweber about her one-woman show Fancy Fool, currently at Z-Space. We'll learn about the new ODC dance season, Walking Distance Festival, this weekend with Christy Bolingbroke. And I'll talk with conductor Donald Runicles and tenor Brian Immel about the San Francisco Opera's epic production of Les Troyennes by Hector Berlioz. Some tickets to give away to the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony as well before the hour's out. Stay with us. New York-based actor Ananda Benaweber brings her original show to Fancy Fool! To San Francisco Z-Space through the 14th of June. It's her third solo show, and in it she makes use of her skills as a dramatic and comic actor, dancer, singer, mime, and vocal impressionist. As a dancer, Benaweber is a founding member and principal with the Sierra Nevada Ballet. She's also performed with the Jazz Tap Ensemble, the Reno Ballet, and Peninsula Ballet Theater. And as an actress, she includes Nevada Shakespeare Company and Broadway by the Bay as among her many credits. With degrees from San Francisco State and Goddard College, she currently serves as an adjunct professor at Marymount Manhattan College and is a teaching artist for the Dance Theater of Harlem. Ananda, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you. Tell us what Fancy Fool! Is all about.
When I first started working on Fancy Fool, the reason was because I'm living in New York about 10 years now. I'm from San Francisco originally, so it's so great to be back. So when I was first there, you know, I was struggling, as I guess a lot of artists do, and I would be sitting around the city, you know, in parks or and on benches or just walking around, you know, doing stuff. And these amazing conversations would happen between me and strangers, which I've started nicknaming Kismet conversations, in which these different people from all walks of life would come up to me and just basically, like, tell me the deepest secrets of their heart and then, like, disappear. And it was so moving. Like, I've never been so moved as I was by all these people. And it basically, it happened hundreds of times. It was really extraordinary. And so
So these are all characters that you've met on the street, basically, that you're bringing to life into the show.
Yeah, like I decided to do this show, you know, based on these conversations that I had and based on what these people shared with me. And so I have basically six characters that none of them are exact interviews, you know, they're all based on these conversations. And since I do clown, you know, they're all clown characters, so clown versions of real people, sharing stories from life and things that make me feel, you know, the relatedness, that all, you know, the saying is really true, you know, a stranger is a friend you haven't met yet. Mm-hmm. You know, we're really all here and we're so similar to each other, you know, and I think it's good to remember that in these times when the media makes us feel a lot of the time that we're separate.
Sure. You know? What's the basic through line of the show?
Well, that's the idea, is that we're all friends who love each other, basically. And then there are different, you know, the different characters, some of them, there's a graffiti artist and there's professor of Shakespeare and there's a scientist, you know, but they're all basically talking about the idea of, like, brotherly love, you know, but in a way that's funny and I think makes you think also.
So bring me the professor and talking about brotherly love. Who is the professor?
Yeah, well, this is Professor Franz Lederhosen. And we are going to speak about fetishes and noses and other topics of interest, you know. But also, you know, how to learn how to love one another, you know, in this current society also. And fetishes and how they help us to do this. And also large noses and how they help us to do this.
Very helpful as a clown to have the large nose, of course.
Yes, so, and he certainly has a big schnozola. So.
Well, one of the characters is a Shakespeare expert, too.
Yes, hello, Delia here. How are you? Yes, we're going to talk about Shakespeare. Shakespeare with a twist, you know, because Shakespeare is for everyone, you know, and the poetry and the philosophy, it makes us feel that we are part of a larger conversation through the ages. Oh, it's beautiful. I'm so excited. excited to be here in San Francisco. I've never been here before. So it's very, very fun for me. Thank you.
And so, is this someone that you met on the streets as well and had a conversation about Shakespeare with?
Delia? Well, no. Delia. Delia is, like most of the characters, an amalgam of different people that I've met and also professors that I've had. I've done a lot of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And I've studied a lot of Shakespeare all over the world. She's like an amalgam of that, but then she relates it to our society now, you know, and I think in a way that's really human and really fun to watch.
I imagine I'm reading about a janitor interaction. Must have been a real life experience that you had.
Yes, based on several, actually. But Jim the janitor. And, the thing is that I think what we need to remember, you know, as a janitor, that, you can be working, like, really small and menial jobs, you know, but if you do a thing really well, you can take pride in that. You know, there's dignity in that. And there are so many of us, you know, who feel, you know, we're doing sort of poor little jobs, and we feel like that makes us less, you know, but it really doesn't. I mean, I'm a person of dignity. I enjoy my life. My lovely wife, Margie, is very beautiful. And, the world, it's a beautiful place, you know, for everybody.
Jim, if I could speak with Ananda once again.
Hi.
Ananda, when did you first catch the performing bug? As a kid, maybe? Family?
I'm my family, absolutely. They're all dancers. My grandparents on my mother's side were dancers. Both my parents are also dancers. And they're dancers in a way where they are very much acting and telling a story with movement and with rhythm and with music. And then I got the clown bug when Bill Irwin, who's my absolute idol, was commissioned to do a piece for my father, Sam Weber, who's a tap dancer, but he's also hilarious.
Oh, I know Sam,
And he created this great clown character for him that's totally him. And I got to watch some of the process of him learning that and working on it. And I was just like, man, I am hooked on this. And so then I started watching, the back work of Bill Irwin. I watched The Regard of Flight, which is just genius. And then I got to see him in Full Moon and he did a Beckett piece. I've seen basically everything I could see him do live. And I think he's just extraordinary. So I've tried very much to emulate him. And coming from ballet, I started as a classical ballet dancer, as you mentioned. That made it easy to do a lot of the physical stuff, you know, in clowning.
Right. Well, in this show, you get to demonstrate some of your classical training and dance.
Yeah, there's three dance numbers in the show, two that are pretty goofy and one that's a little bit more serious.
What will we see on stage? There's some projections, I believe, from your time in New York?
Yeah, well, there's some wonderful films made by Joanne Seberg Baker and all sorts of different ones that look really beautiful in this ultra HD. They're really gorgeous. And some of them are about life in New York City that's a little bit more serious. And then some of them are just, you know, there's a big splash musical number at the end, music video, which is just kind of kooky with all the characters in it.
So. Neat. Who helped you shape this production, Fancy Fool?
It's directed by Rosine Benna, the artistic director of Sierra Nevada Ballet.
Mm-hmm. So you must have had to whittle down all of these characters or try to create the amalgams of several characters in order to fit it into a show of the length it is.
Yeah, it's about an hour and a half plus intermission, and that's absolutely true. We found that we had material for two or three shows, but this one, I think it has a really beautiful through line. It's like a love letter, you know, and it's really funny, but it makes you think. So.
I noticed in the preview online that you also share with us the frustrations of being on hold.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's sort of juxtaposes the things that make us feel separate from each other, like those technological boundaries, you know, and then suggests through the characters, which are based on the things that these people on the street said, ways that we can get together and the need to get together and the return to the heart as a way of connecting with one another.
That's Ananda Weber, who is in her one-person show, Fancy Fool, at ZSpace, Z below. Information at zspace.org or at anandabenaweber.com. I'll spell that for you. Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A-B-E-N-A, Weber, W-E-B-E-R.com. Ananda, thanks so much for coming in. I wish you a wonderful run at ZSpace. It's a fun space to watch a show.
It's wonderful. Yes, thank you so much.
Vibre de verre, je ne sais vibrer qu'en paratonnerre. Je suis condamnée à l'éclair, la foudre éphémère. Car si l'on m'aime, l'on doit me consumer. Mais demain, oui, demain.
Still to come on Open Air, details about the new ODC dance season. And next, opera on a grand scale. San Francisco Opera presents the long-awaited return of one of the most significant pieces in the operatic repertoire, Berlioz's Les Troyens, set to and text by the composer and based on Virgil's classical poem, The Aeneid. After an absence of 47 years, Les Troyens is presented in a massive and visually striking production with the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, Milan's Teatro alla Scala, and the Vienna State Opera, conceived by David McVicker, one of the world's leading producers for the Lyric Theater, and directed here by Leah Hausman. It's massive in many ways, not just in terms of the vocal principals, choristers, dancers, acrobats, and supernumeraries, some 134 cast members in total, a burgeoning 72-member orchestra in the pit, another 23 offstage, audibly surrounding the audience, but massive in weight as well, the scenery coming in at 32 tons and requiring special reinforcement of the San Francisco Opera stage. Over the course of 5.5 hours, Berlioz's five-act visionary masterpiece explores the power of fate and the complex reign of gods over mortals as it depicts the end of a 10-year Greek-Trojan War, the tragic fall of Troy, the great North African city of Carthage, and the passionate love of two great leaders. The cast is headlined by mezzo-soprano Susan Graham and tenor Brian Immel as the ill-fated lovers Dido and Aeneas. Former San Francisco Opera music director Donald Runicles, who is currently general music director at Deutsche Oper Berlin, returns to conduct the San Francisco Opera Orchestra and Chorus, which was prepared by Ian Robertson. And yesterday I caught up with Maestro Runicles and tenor Brian Immel at the Opera House. Maestro Runicles, welcome back to San Francisco and the bowels of the building that you know so very well.
It's a great pleasure to be back, David.
With these productions, you're joining a very exclusive group of conductors who have actually conducted fully staged versions of a minimally cut Les Troyens, including your colleague Charles Dutoit, currently across the street in a San Francisco Symphony guest conducting engagement. Has this particular opera held a personal fascination for you, and if so, since when?
The music of Berlioz has held me rapt, really, ever since I became interested in symphonic conducting and certainly in opera. Of course, initially it's the Symphonie Fantastique, it's the orchestral war horses. Specifically, though, the Trojans, it's quite a yarn. This goes back to actually it's a very serendipitous meeting of artists, if you like. Back in the late 90s, at the Edinburgh Festival, I had the privilege to work for the first time with Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. We were doing the Rape of Lucretia, and it was just a remarkable, remarkable partnership. And on the basis of that, the then general administrator of the Edinburgh Festival, Brian McMaster, who had always wanted to put on the Trojans, had suggested we do this together. She had never sung Didon. We jumped at the chance. And this was then in 2001. I say serendipitous because at this time, Pamela Rosenberg, who used to be general director here at the San Francisco Opera, and I were hatching plans for Berlioz, more Berlioz. And the Trojans was certainly on our radar, on the horizon. So this all rather came together, and I did that with Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. I will never forget those two evenings. We did the opera over two evenings. I'll never forget one the opera two, the epic nature of this story, and three, of course, and one says this with great sadness, the fact that Lorraine was only given to us for such a short period of time because of her tragic death. And this was in 2001. She went on to sing it at the Met. I then didn't conduct it here because those plans had to be shelved for a variety of reasons, and we brought it in Berlin about 5 years ago.
So is this perhaps part of your exit strategy of San Francisco Opera, having such a successful history here? When you left back in 2009, you say, okay, I'm leaving, but I'm coming back in 2015 to do Les Troyennes. Was that part of the plan back then?
Oh, I'd love to take credit for that, but no. The person to take credit for that most certainly is David Gockley. This was a third time lucky because it had the opera had been basically postponed twice. And I came back for the 2011 Ring Cycles, and even then David was talking about, we have to finally do the Trojans. And that's when he asked if I would come to do it. And along the lines of, oh, we have this five-hour opera, get Renicles. Anyway, I'm thrilled to be back.
This opera has such a tortured history. Poor Berlioz never saw the entire production mounted as he envisioned it. A constant barrage of cuts suggested by outsiders.
Yes, it's one is fascinated, or one would be fascinated to know what Berlioz might indeed have done in terms of revisions, cuts, redactions, on account of actually having heard the entire work. But as you say, David, he never had a chance to hear it. It really was his love child in many ways, and he considered it his finest work, his most important work. And it has, for a variety of reasons, not least of which is budget, been put on worldwide, but very rarely complete. And as you say, in this David McVicar production, there are minimal cuts. I think there are a few cuts we make where I'm sure Berlioz, let's say he had to get a chorus of 200 on stage, he had to write enough music to get 200 people on stage, and they didn't have then the wherewithal or the technical advantages to get people on quickly. So you'll find many repeats in choruses, and it's basically
vamps.
Well, yes, vamped already, sort of thing, entrances and exits and things like that. We've been very judicious in certainly not cutting anything that of intrinsic musical quality.
Well, the opera was done last here in the late 60s with significant cuts. These performances only have minor cuts, but still makes for a 5.5 hour evening of opera. Who was involved with restoring all of that cut music? And more importantly, who did you guys line up for a coffee sponsor for the evening?
Well, you'll have to ask the San Francisco Opera that with regard to the coffee. The music was always there. I mean, there is this Berlioz edition. It's all there. There's a great deal more, incidentally, that we don't perform. He himself played around with it. And once again, if he had had a chance to hear it, who knows what he might have done. There's a book just of music that he didn't include. It's really, really quite fascinating. And the end of the opera, he had an extended ending, he had an abrupt ending. You see all of this, and it's we haven't put together anything. This is not a 10th Symphony of Gustav Mahler. This is not a reconstruction. This is all the way he wrote it, and it will be obviously for the audience to decide, but it's some of the most dramatic, some of the most beautiful, some of the most sensuous, some of the most overwhelmingly powerful music you will ever, ever hear and experience in an opera house.
This David McVicar conceived production received its premiere in London in 2012, was subsequently presented in Milan in 2014, now receiving its U.S. debut. Were you involved at all in those productions? Perhaps even just as a fly on the wall to see them?
No, sadly, I lead a very busy life, and primarily when it comes to opera, I'm in Berlin. We live in Berlin, so I really have never had the chance to see be there live. But I have most certainly seen pictures of it, and I've heard reports of it. And I wasn't involved in that, but most certainly when it came to the casting of this 2015 revival of this production, or U.S. premiere. I collaborated closely with David Gockley when it came to the casting.
With Grand Opera, of course, artistic freedom comes into play when directors want to change the time period, update the costumes, use puppetry, projections. Let's talk about the horse.
Horse? Is it a horse? Oh, gosh, I should look up more often. It can be one of the most powerful, or one of the most cliched, or one of the cheesiest of things to see in our world of computer graphics and what we expect to see in the movie theater. It's really very challenging to bring something on the opera stage which is really believable and breathtaking. I think this is, and not only because I'm very much a part of this project, I think this is one of the most effective horses I've ever seen, and it has a, it's very hard to describe. It looks like something out of a Terminator film. It really looks timeless. It's not something, you know immediately it's a horse. There's an image at the very end of the opera, and spoiler alert, there's an image at the very end of the opera which is similarly breathtaking when you don't know it's coming. And it's very hard to describe. You know what it is, but it's done in such a way that you feel it could belong to any era. And I that's what I do love about this production. It while it is specific in some ways to the story and the timing of the whole Greek Carthage story tragedy, it nevertheless has a very timeless feel to it. And I think it's been it's a terrific solution.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. In this production, the costumes are updated to 1855, and Troy resembles the Battle of Sebastopol and the Crimean War, with the Trojan costumes resembling the various nations involved in the Crimean conflict. Seeing what we've just seen in the Middle East, and the aspect of history repeating itself, is that on your mind at all when you think of the bigger picture and the larger story?
David, I think that any great piece of art has to maintain its relevance, or I should put that differently. I think a great work of art will always have a relevance. It's for us to find it. And in opera, these great works such as Les Troyens from Hector Berlioz, the story and the way he relates the story to an audience is timely. That is to say, the whole, this epic odyssey from Troy to Carthage, is populated with human beings, people who feel emotions, people who feel betrayed, people who feel sad, who feel exhilarated. It is also, I think that's one of the most powerful aspects of this, particularly in light of what you've just suggested with the Middle East. Who are the Cassandras? The Cassandras, we know the figure in Troy, who has these visions, who sees what is going to happen, and who warns people who just don't take her seriously, think, oh, that'll never happen, who warns people of facts and actions have consequences, and this is leading us somewhere very dangerous, and the ramifications will be huge over generations. Well, go figure, in 2015, who are the Cassandras leading up to the various conflicts, whether it's in the Middle East or whether it's in Russia, whether it's in Europe? There are people out there who are uncomfortable because they're telling you something which is not politically correct. It's something that they feel existentially about. Who are those Cassandras? And that's why I think and that's what I think comes across so well in this production. There's the relevance. It should make us think about. It's fine to be uncomfortable. It's fine to find something disturbing. There are those out there who should be listened to, but it's just
Have to find the filter for that. Yeah.
Well, yes, and it just has to have the courage to look at yourself and be able to be aware that you're wrong, or that is pride leading to a fall? Is it the vanity in one that leads one to do things that others are saying no, don't, but somehow we feel no, I know best, and then something calamitous happens. Anyway, I'm not talking about something idealistic. That is what this piece is about. It is telling this story. But there is something for everybody to be able to relate to their own lives or to our own political, social situation.
In my introduction, I listed some of the massive forces that are at your command. Yet it has to come down to the singer or the singers and the orchestra that I imagine is your ultimate concern. Can you be distracted by everything that's going on stage, or you just block it out and focus?
I think the premise of the question, with respect, is wrong. I'm not distracted. I am completely obsessed with it. I a great production makes me a better conductor. The energy between the synergy, the energy between people, to have this phenomenal chorus. Their energy and the this visceral sort of eye contact, not visceral, I mean this visceral energy, it's like a cushion of air in a hovercraft. It lifts the performance up, and yes, it's very complex. There's a lot of strands, but as I say, this production and one thing as a conductor that you're always very grateful for is a director who really has taken the music very seriously and who knows where the challenges would be in terms of just coordination. Coordination with a singer, coordination with a chorus. Where are they on stage? Are they off stage? I think David has found some really terrific and musically exciting solutions which make my life a great deal easier when it comes to coordinating hundreds of people on the stage, off the stage, above the stage, under the stage, and then I have a not insignificant task in the pit. So, not to mention all the offstage, the bandas, which are, and we hope the audience will revel in the fact that they are quite literally surrounded, physically surrounded by sound, and actually people playing behind them, without wishing to give too much away. And I think that's something that, not I think, I know that that's something that Berlioz was always fascinated by, the spatial effect of music, placing orchestras around the auditorium.
It's so fascinating. You were mentioning earlier about his orchestration, how I remember reading about it, he would much rather hear the sound of five cymbals playing pianissimo than one cymbal player playing piano. It's the color that he's after.
Yes, I mean the palette of colors that Berlioz availed himself of is staggering, and you can only imagine back in the 1840s, 50s, orchestral players looking at him saying, "I can't play that." You know, I can't play that on my instrument. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Just shift your finger a little higher or a little less pressure. I mean, we know he's the father of the modern orchestra, and his book about orchestration, you sense it's a must read for, it clearly was a must read for many, many composers following him in the 19th century. So many of the, if I say effects, that sounds a little superficial, but orchestral effects, they began with Berlioz, and through that he creates something. It's particularly in an opera where there are ghosts and specters, and there is this supernatural element to the work. He manages, through a somewhat traditional orchestra, to create the most eerie, spooky, chilling, wonderful sounds.
There's a notoriously difficult first entrance for your Aeneas, Brian Emel. Do you have to constantly keep the orchestra down in spite of the full, richly orchestrated sound that Berlioz is conjuring up?
I think, David, it's something that you adapt according to the size of an opera house. It's that is to say, certain spaces, larger spaces, you have to be, or the acoustic of the pit or the acoustic of the house, you have to gauge the orchestral dynamic according to the space. That is to say, the Met has a very different acoustic to San Francisco, and there's some reductions there you perhaps may have to make that you don't make here because the acoustics are very different. One is always, I mean, I have assistants in the house who, with whom I'm in contact regularly about balance, and there's no question, if the orchestra has a very loud dynamic written for it and you can't hear the singer, then you have to do something about it. But I have to say, and I don't have to say, I'm thrilled to say that Brian is one of the most exciting singers I've ever worked with, and he really makes a superhuman role sound almost easy. It's really staggering, besides being this lovely, lovely guy. That, you're absolutely right, that first entry is just this banana skin just waiting to be stepped on, you know, for some tenors. But he acquits himself with just with joy and virtuosity, and yeah.
Brian at least has a couple of breaks between his main scenes, but except for 2 30-minute intermissions, you're on that podium for the whole schmear. I mean, that has to be physically exhausting. What do you do to prepare for something like this, other than making sure you're wearing sensible shoes?
Oh, potty breaks. I always make sure, well, of course, you try to come, you pace your day. My day has to peak at 5:30 until 11 o'clock at night, so to speak. But that is true of any artist or any performing artist. But you have to, as I say, pace the day. I drink a lot of Gatorade, and I eat quite a few bananas. That's no old wives' tale. I find it really gives you this shot of energy. It really is the next morning you realize just how long the evening was, because of course the adrenaline kicks in, and last night's general rehearsal, there was a very large enthusiastic crowd, and the never ever underestimate the impact of an audience that is so enthusiastic. It takes you and gives you energy that you didn't even think you had.
So at the end of the day, it's you're not only exhausted but exhilarated then. What's the wind down for you then? Double scotch, or is it?
No, the wind down is the wine. I would say just a glass of wine or a glass of beer. I mean, obviously, I've drunk masses of water through the performance. That's obviously very important. But just spending some time with the artist afterwards, just socializing, talking a little bit about the evening over a glass of Chardonnay. It's a great life.
What's next after Le Troyen?
I go to the Grand Teton Music Festival, where I spend much of the summer. We have a number of orchestral programs. That starts in July. And in between that, I have appearances at the Proms in London and the Edinburgh Festival. So it's a busy time, but it's been a thrill to be back in an opera house that I love so much and that played such an important part in my life, and to spend an extended time here, it's because it is quite a peripatetic existence, and it's a thrill to be back.
Well, I wish you fantastic performances of the Berlioz and some maybe a little less intense time up at the Grand Tetons, but I'm sure some wonderful music. Thanks for taking some time tonight.
It's good to talk with you again, David.
all too brief excerpt for contractual obligations from the San Francisco Opera dress rehearsal of Les Troyennes by Hector Berlioz. Some of the most transfixing music from the opera in the fourth act when, entranced by the evening's entertainment of singing and dancing, the Trojan hero Aeneas, sung by tenor Brian Ymel, and Dido, the Queen of Carthage, Susan Graham, declare their love in the duet, O Night of Infinite Ecstasy. I also caught up with tenor Brian Ymel yesterday at the Opera House. Brian, thanks so much for taking some time out of your day after a five-hour epic dress rehearsal last night.
Yes, it's my pleasure. It was fun to actually do the whole thing, you know, parts one and two together, for the first time in this run of the shows.
You've got an interesting relationship with this role of Aeneas. Back in 2013, for the International Met in HD broadcast, you famously filled in at the very last minute for Marcello Giordani. The pressure must have been tremendous.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, it was huge, and I don't want to downplay it too much, but I would say without the experience of London a few months earlier and that having to step in for Jonas Kaufmann, who, you know, is kind of everything that he sings is kind of just as the way you would imagine it. And, you know, and having, since he had not done the role, there was kind of like all this expectation to live up to. And that, the weight of that really was very heavy. And so when I got to the Met, and I knew, I mean, Marcello and I have the same voice teacher. I know him. I've known him for years and looked up to him. And you know, it was a little bit bittersweet, but, you know, he was struggling and he said, I need to pull out of this, you know, and the fact that they have you and that you can do it, makes me feel better about it. And so, yeah, so it was great. I mean, yes, obviously the pressure of an HD, but it was fresh in my voice. It was fresh in my mind. And, you know, I mean, I think all those years of studying in university and coming to Marilla and doing all these kinds of young artist programs, you know, if you're lucky enough to get a chance like that, you have to step up and do it.
Yeah. Well, but this is a five-hour epic. It's not something you just keep in your back pocket like established repertory roles like the Duke and Rigoletto or any number of other tenor roles.
Yeah, that's very true. One of the things that made the Covent Garden situation possible was the fact that I had learned it and did it in Amsterdam, and so I already knew it. And the thing is, it's one of the last roles I learned while I was still at school in AVA in Philadelphia. So I had, you know, maybe 6 or 7 weeks to put this into my voice and to, like, live with it. It wasn't the only thing I was singing at the time, because I think I was actually doing Traviata at the time. But over, you know, the point being is that by letting it come in slowly and not having to cram it in and jam it in, it stayed in a really good place. And also, it's a role I've learned with only my last teacher. I mean, I don't have, if you take Rigoletto, Bohème, Lucia, I sang, you know, some of those roles with each one with a different teacher. You know, the first time I did the Duke, which I'm going to do right after this in Santa Fe, I was 20. I did it at Opera Grand Rapids, and so that was my first singer's technique. And then the next time I did it was at Aspen 4 years later with a different teacher and a different technique. And then I did it again in Baltimore, I guess, 2 seasons ago with my third teacher and a different technique. And, you know, now it's kind of a melding of all of those things. And they were all wonderful teachers. But where I was at the time and what I could accept and understand was limited. And so now I can kind of get it all together, but I still fight old muscle memories from in there. You know, the Bohème after doing, I mean, I did 10 performances or 11 performances of Bohème this year. I'll do 10 at the Met this coming year. And every night and every day before the show, I have to get there and just mentally sing through that aria and make sure that I'm singing it the way I want to sing it now, which I think is better than I could say 2 or 3 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago when I first learned it, you know. So on the one hand, you know, it is all those epic things. But on the other hand, you know, I think that's why I've had such a success with it, is that I really just it's been put into my throat and into my body kind of only one way. And fortunately, it was a good way, and it was an efficient way. I mean, I think that's what you need in these like monster long roles, and in order to sing them beautifully. I mean, you don't want to just get through it. That shouldn't be the goal, to just survive, you know. So.
How nice too to be the first pick for this production.
Yeah, indeed, absolutely.
Now, do you or perhaps your people keep track of other performances of Les Troyens that are being planned to be on standby, or you're already engaged to be on call for some other productions?
No, I'm not engaged to be on call for any other productions. We do kind of sort of know. I mean, anytime you do a piece like Les Troyens where there's only maybe two or three people who have sung it, people, you know, the opera companies who are putting them on are in, you know, they either want me or they don't want me, or I'm not free or something like that. You know, it was kind of a sticky situation for me when, after doing the one at Covent Garden, Tony Papano and David McVicar wanted me to go to La Scala to do it, and I wanted to go to La Scala to do it. But I had contracts in Vienna and Zurich, and they were both debut contracts, and one was Hoffmann, and that was really the one that they were like, we can't get anybody else, and so sorry, we wish you could, you know, we wish it was different, but we can't release you. So, and so that was kind of tricky. But I know a couple places are doing it. I'm doing it in some of those places, and not in some of the other ones. So we'll see.
I talked with the maestro a little bit about your notoriously difficult first entrance. Are you able to hear yourself rise above that orchestral tumult, or you just trust that Maestro Renicles is keeping the orchestra at bay?
No, I trust that he's keeping it. I can sense it, because the acoustics of this house in San Francisco are really very, very good. But yeah, I mean, you come out. I mean, in this production, we have to run all the way from the back of the stage down to the front of the stage, which that is almost, I mean, that is the most difficult part, because
you have to have breath support, and you have to be able to.
Yeah, but it's more about like when you do that, it gets your blood pressure high, and also you're telling this story, which is fantastical and terrifying, as you saw the priest get eaten by these two serpents, and there's, you know, bloody saliva and all this other kind of stuff that he says. So, you know, and the way it's written is difficult, but it's really just about, you just have to take in as relaxed of a breath as you can, and then expel it by telling the story. And then when you have the time to rest, just kind of breathe in and kind of try and keep your heart as calm as it can, because that's, I think, really that's what makes your breath get high. It's the anxiousness, it's the all that kind of stuff, which, you know, in roles in an opera, you have to split the difference between the emotion that you show and that you need to have in order to be acting the part, while still having the kind of calmness to sing it beautifully. Yes, I mean, it should be beautiful, but at the same time, it should be terrifying. But you don't want to sound strained, you know. It's balancing all those kinds of things. And so I've been told that there's no balance problems, so I rely on that by people that I trust and the music staff, and I know he's doing a good job of keeping them down, because they have to be exciting too. They can't just play like softly and like don't cover up the singer. I mean, you know, obviously you want to be able to hear them, but at the same time, Berlioz paints the serpents with the trombones and with other things that you need to have them there. You can't just be like, oh well, just kind of flub that up. No, I mean, that's why I think this kind of music fits me, is because I do have the high tessitura, but then when it calls for, you know, resources of sound, I can kind of go down there, you know.
As much as I'm sure you'd like to celebrate with friends and colleagues after these performances, you've got to keep your vocal and physical health in mind foremost, not only for these rehearsals and five performances, but as you mentioned, you're off to Santa Fe Opera right on the heels of these epic performances to appear as the Duke in Rigoletto. Anything special that you do to make sure that the instrument is kept in check?
Yeah, I mean, I think I try to, obviously water, hydrating, sleep, and not talking too much, I think, are really the biggest things. I mean, you just have to kind of rest your voice.
Okay, I'll leave now. That's it.
No. We're okay right now. I got 4 days off, and I'm not going to Santa Fe. But certainly once the show starts, I'm going to be very judicious on where I go. I mean, I'm not going to be going out and having wine and drinks and staying out late and talking, because, I mean, I did it last night because I've been very good since I've been here, and I knew I had 4 days off. And I'm fine, but I just, you know, you don't want to get to the point to where if I'm at, you know, after singing last night, if I started out at 98%, by the end of it, I was down to like 90% or 85% energy. And I went to sleep, and now I'm back at like, you know, 87, 88. And the thing is, you don't want to just keep doing that for weeks, and all of a sudden you start getting down into like the 60s. Because you just don't have the energy. And even, you know, people would say, oh, well, we don't hear it. Well, there's a difference between not hearing it and still feeling it physically, because I can get down very low on energy and still sound pretty good, but I know I'm on the, like, starting to get into the zone of maybe getting sick or getting tired. And, you know, one or two performances that the adrenaline comes up for the show, and then the next day you crash and you wake up feeling a little bit feverish or something like that. And so, yeah, it's tricky. But, I mean, that's the life. I mean, this is very taxing in an obvious way, because I'm singing a performance and then flying to Santa Fe. But really, the last 6 months have been like that for sure. I mean, you know, this is just more obvious. And flying back and forth between the U.S. and America, and doing promotion for the record and doing interviews and flying. I mean, I flew between performances of Bohem in Dallas to New York to promote the record and do the Opera News cover shoot and all these other kinds of things. And it catches up with you. You know, so it's, but that's what it is now. That's what it is to be an opera singer at that level now. You have to, I mean, I'm learning, it's a learning curve, but I have people, you know, my manager and my teachers and other people to say, like, okay, well, you got to do this. You know, if you are going to have this level of career, you have to kind of
base yourself.
Yeah, you have to be smarter. Then, and you can't just do everything you want to do because you want to. You know, you have to go home early or just not go out with everybody after and drinking, you know. I mean, because it's funny, in this role and rehearsing this role, you know, you realize that the other characters, there's lots of other characters, and they kind of have their one moment to do something, or, you know, like the Anna duet with Didon. Didon has a lot, obviously. And Cassandra does. But the other characters, they kind of come in, they do the one thing, and then that's it. They're there through the rest of the evening, but they don't have to keep delivering, you know. And so each one of the entries that I have is like a sprint, especially the first one. And then with the ghost, it's pretty calm, but then the guys come in, and then you have to sing all this, like, come on, let's go. We're going to go try and save what we can of Troy. And then you're off for an hour and 15 minutes. So you have to try and keep the energy up. While still not spending too much, because you still got a lot to sing. Yeah, it's tricky.
Well, how very timely. We mentioned your CD that came out on Warner Classics, Heroic French Opera Arias, and it happens to include an aria from the Berlioz. Yeah. Now, is this going to be your new niche, perhaps? You mentioned that one of the arias had to be reconstructed from and re-put together for the orchestrations. Yeah. Would you like to see more of this repertoire come to the fore?
You know, I would love to see this repertoire just kind of be reintroduced. I mean, I think that there's so much in the catalog of what we have in opera, you know, and it's cyclical, and there are things that kind of fall into fashion and out of fashion. And, you know, I think French grand opera presents certain issues that have to be dealt with from a storytelling standpoint, from a just from a budgetary standpoint. I mean, the forces and the amount of people that are needed to be involved in this, in putting on such a grand production, is immense. And in our economic climate, it maybe is not the wisest spending of the limited resources and the shrinking resources that opera has, and classical music for that matter. But, you know, I think the music is wonderful. And I think things like Opera Orchestra of New York and other places that do these operas in concert, that's better than nothing. That's better than being forgotten. And that's what's happened to a lot of these pieces that are there. You know, these ones by Massenet, Gounod, wonderful composers with huge amount of gorgeous and beautiful music that just is a little bit under. Even in France, this music is underappreciated. You know, I guess it's kind of, Sometimes they tell me that they even turn their nose up at Berlioz. They think it's just a little bit too much, you know, too fantastique. That's what I always hear. Oh, Berlioz, right? Symphony Fantastique. All of his music is too fantastique. And after having just done his Requiem, or the Mass for the Dead, over in the Philharmonie in Paris, which is their new big opera concert hall, it's great, but it's amazing. There are three offstage bands, as there are here, three or antiphonal horn sections, and it's great to get it together, but it's hard. It's so hard. But it's awesome to hear, and that's a chorus of 120, an orchestra of at least 90, another 40 offstage people, and one tenor soloist. You know what I mean? It's crazy. It's crazy, but it's fun to do this, and I hope that you know, for places that are able to do it, it's great, and the music is will be worth it. You know, the audience will be pleased.
Well, Brian, toy for these performances here and in Santa Fe. Let's be sure to visit next time you're in town.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Well, Brian, from your Warner Classics Héroïque French opera aria, I mentioned that there is an aria of Berlioz from Les Troyens in the CD. Set the scene for us, if you would.
Absolutely. So this comes in Act 5, 4 hours and 15 minutes into the opera. And this is during the intermission, Aene and Didon have kind of had an argument about how he's saying he's got to leave. The gods are telling him that it's his duty to go and found the city of Rome. That's his charge. And that's why he left Troy. Well, he left Troy because it was burning, but that's what he set off to do. And he just by chance happened upon Carthage. And so this little detour, which has been wonderful, is great, but he's really got to go and do what he's been sent by the gods to do. And so they have just had this, and he tells the audience kind of what has happened and how hard it's going to be to say that last goodbye to her, and how her tears will be cleansing, and he will feel this, but that hopefully she will understand that in the greater scheme of things, his destiny is to go and do this. He knows she's not going to buy it, but he's trying.
Brian Immel with the Prague Philharmonia. Emmanuel Vuillaume conducting.
Serai-je capable dernier naufrage. Ah, puis-je pénir si je quittais Carthage sans te revoir plutôt? En un dernier naufrage. Oui, puis-je pénir si je quittais Carthage sans te revoir, sans avoir lâcheté, mépris des droits sacrés, de l'hospitalité, reine adorée, reine adorée, âme sublime, et par moi déchirée, reine adorée, âme sublime, et par moi te revoir une dernière fois, pressée tes mains tremblantes, arrosée tes genoux de mes larmes brûlantes.
Tenor Brian Immel starring in Les Troyennes by Hector Berlioz at San Francisco Opera. Information at sfopera.com about those performances. My apologies to Christy Bolingbroke, ODC's Deputy Director of Advancement, and to the good people of ODC. A brief segment I had recorded yesterday with Christy fell victim to technical difficulties, I'm afraid. ODC's Walking Distance Festival kicks off their new season this weekend. Over 2 days, you'll see three programs, as well as some free outdoor performances on Saturday of K.T. Nelson's Transit. All of the programs explore the theme of home and finding one's place in the world. Joining Raw Dance on the festival's opening program is Galim Dance out of New York, making its Bay Area debut. They'll be dancing to some of the music that you're going to hear just now from Balkan Beatbox. You'll also catch a touch of Bollywood on Saturday with Namita Kapoor and some Hindu swing. Lots more going on for ODC Dance this weekend. Do check out their website for full program information, odcdance.org. As promised at the beginning of the hour, I am going to give some tickets away, though. We're a media sponsor for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, presenting A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Woman this Saturday, June 6th, at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Conductor Dawn Harms welcomes transgender pianist Sarah Davis Buchner for Clara Schumann's Piano Concerto, Vitaslava Kapralova's Partita for Piano and Strings, and the Serenade by Ethel Smythe. We have four pairs of tickets to people who call us now in studio, 415-841-4134. 841-4134 for pianist Sarah Davis Buchner appearing with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony and conductor Dawn Harms. 841-4134. Four pairs of complimentary tickets. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air this week, and my apologies again to ODC Dance. Promise to have them on again soon for a more extended segment. And do catch the SF Opera's production of Les Troyennes at the Opera House in this coming week. sfopera.com for more information. A fantastic production. Open Air is archived at our website, kalw.org. You can also send me some segment suggestions, david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. Obija, fija, fija, obija, obija, fija, mija, la sabija, men. Obija, fija, fija, obija.